in old school games where life is cheap. Bring a pole or rope, don't go down in a heap.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the Down in a Heap podcast. I'm your host Rob, podcasting to you live from beautiful Northeast Minneapolis. There at the top of the show, you heard Jason Connerly from Nerds RPG Variety Cast doing his death metal version of my theme song. Thanks for that, Jason. And we will hear from Jason shortly with a call regarding my last show. Today, we will delve further into Bard Games, The Complete Adventurer. We'll see how many classes I can get through, but it'll be at least two, but we'll see how much of a gas bag I am. One thing I wanted to note, yesterday I was at Half Price Books, and I usually comb, if I remember to do it, comb through the old section of paperbacks, combing for old fantasy and stuff, and while I buy some once in a while, I don't really read it much, but the ones I constantly look for are Three Hearts and Two Lions? I can't remember. The Paul Anderson book that is part of Appendix N that's supposed to be so influential on some of the classic tropes in D&D, like alignment along with Moorcock and the troll and I think paladins and and whatnot, but I never find that. And I'm also looking for Clark Ashton Smith. I hear about him, but that's an author I've never read. Well, yesterday I found a collection of short stories. I don't know if this was how they were originally published or not, but it's just called Hyperborea, and apparently it's a collection of his stories that take place in that setting or that theme or whatever. So I'm looking forward to digging into that to see if it's, you know, something that that I like. And, yeah. All right. Without further ado, let's check in and see what Jason has to say.
Hey, Rob. Jason here. Thank you for the kind words. Hopefully I get to collaborate with you to finish off the Universal Monster series. That'd be kind of cool. As far as the classes that you mentioned this time, you know, I don't think I want to see the Buccaneer there. I think those are kind of things that everybody should be able to try to do. Some are going to be better at it than others. You could almost make it more of a background skills kind of thing. Secondary skills, career, I don't know what you want to call them, but kind of like in AD&D where you've got the list of your secondary skills you can roll on. And maybe Buccaneer or Sailor could be one of those, and that would imply a lot of these things. But it's tough because you want to keep niche protection, but at the same time, you build all these things in there, like, you know, the ability to use the grappling hook and the Kosh and all these kind of things that aren't specific to just the Buccaneer, right? It almost goes back to when you were designing your role-playing game and having the smorgasbord of things people can pick from. And, you know, well, I want this character to be able to do the cannon judo chop to knock somebody out, so I'm going to choose that as opposed to only the Buccaneer being able to do that, or only the private eye in this case, the overweight private eye in this case, right? But yeah, I don't know. It's interesting. The Beastmaster, I do like. I wonder how many people really do play pets and mounts and things fully in their games. I kind of think most players, or most games, they do fade in the background, then come back up when they're used, but otherwise they fade in the background. When you go to the inn, you're not looking for somewhere for your dog to stay, and you're not worrying about carrying rations for your dog. And I'm sure some players definitely do that, but especially with horses, I probably not so like special pets. I think players with special pets probably do pay more attention to them, and a Beastmaster probably would pay more attention. But I think horses tend to be forgotten a lot of times too. Now, if you're in an older system that uses hirelings and henchmen things, and obviously if you have somebody that, you know, a squire, whatever, you know, a retainer that takes care of your horses, then that's not a big deal, and that wouldn't probably cost that much money. And if you're doing a bigger adventure, that's the kind of thing you do, is you hire somebody to take care of the horses. That also explains what happens to them while you're in the dungeon. But anyhow, I look forward to future episodes. I'm enjoying your show, and again, thank you for the kind words. I'll talk to you soon.
Hey, thanks for the call, Jason. I appreciate it. And just to note, the status update on Nerds RPG Variety Cast, Jason did post his last episode. I believe the title is called Coda. And in it, he said that he hasn't decided for sure yet what he's going to do, other than he's taking May off. So he said, essentially, stay tuned. There might be something, there might be a return to podcasting, but in a different format. And that might be, or it's most likely, if he returns, is going to be some kind of tandem podcast where he either has a, I'm not sure if it'll have like a standard co-host, you know, basically a team that always is together podcasting with maybe occasional guests, or if it's going to be a rotating cast of co-hosts based upon, you know, that maybe is determined by the topic that they're discussing, or if it's like a regular cast of people that, like his Cerebrivore podcast, where there's two, three people, four on at a time, but it's kind of the same group of people that come in and out of the podcast and stuff. But I hope Jason does return to podcasting, because I enjoy the things he talks about, and just listening to him and the various people he has on his podcast. And yeah, we're trying to work our schedules out so that we can get one last Universal Monster movie episode in together, the Creature from the Black Lagoon. Regarding the other things that you called about with the Complete Adventurer, I agree with your assessment on the Buccaneer. I think there are classes, not only in this booklet, but throughout D&D and its iterations, where it's almost like filler, or it's reaching for something that doesn't really have a solid foundation for what makes this class different than just a fighter that is also a seaman, you know, or a fighter that's also a woodsman, or a thief that also is a fence or something like that. So in general, I am not a fan of a proliferation, if I can talk this morning, of classes. I think they usually end up being superfluous, and sometimes it's just role-playing devices and background skills that could take the place of the class. And the Buccaneer, I think, falls firmly into that camp of something where it's just like, yeah, you're a fighter that has the background of a seaman, and trying to attach all these different fighting techniques and then making seamanship something that improves as your level increases, and then tacking on appraised treasure, doesn't feel like enough of a class. And especially, as I pointed out, when you consider the shortcomings of the class, the lack of heavy armor and the lack of missile weapon availability, it doesn't really become a palatable class unless your whole campaign revolves around piracy and adventuring in the high seas and stuff. And yeah, the approach, I guess, you're talking about here is the difference between making a ton of different classes to satisfy every player's kind of wish list or something, like the old NPC classes in Dragon Magazine, where, well, I want to be Robin Hood, so we'll create an archer class, you know, rather than just using the fighter as a template and saying, all right, you get some kind of special ability with a bow, and in return for that to balance it out, you can only wear leather armor or something. I don't know. But the other approach is to, yeah, create like some kind of smorgasbord where you can choose these various specialties or traits, or, you know, you could say feats, right? To personalize your character rather than, like you say, having the the judo chop as a special maneuver rather than creating an overweight private eye class who has the judo chop as one of their class abilities. Pets and mounts, yeah, in my experience, they generally do just fade into the background unless they're needed. The dog never gets attacked by monsters and stuff unless the magic user all of a sudden is, oh, wait a minute, some monsters broke through our skirmish line and now I'm threatened. My dog is right here to protect me. And it's almost like a robe of useful items where they pull off the dog patch and and there it is. We haven't talked about it for three sessions, but it's been here the whole time. And I agree that in general, things that are special pets, quote unquote, like a druid's animal companions or a magic user's familiar, tend to get played up a lot more than just someone's mule or horse or something. And those a lot of times are just taken care of with upkeep costs. And it hasn't really come up in my campaigns much, but it does seem like that would be a good role for a hireling, is to have like a squire or someone that handles your horses, your pack animals, some kind of mule skinner, and then maybe some kind of kennel keeper if you have a big pack of hunting dogs or something like that. I do kind of, it's starting to develop in my campaign. They cast sleep spell, I think, on a group of monkeys, and one of Keith's characters, Elf, has animal trainer as a background skill, and he's trying to train these monkeys and stuff. And Adam has a druid, and he casts animal friendship on one of the monkeys, and he also has animal friendship, I think, on a bat. So it's starting to become a little bit of a circus. I don't know what the plan is for these monkeys, but it doesn't seem very reasonable that you could expect the monkeys to follow you into, say, like some kind of old tomb that smells weird and is not at all the type of habitat that a monkey would be comfortable going into. So I don't know what the expectation is for the monkeys. We'll find out. And if I'm still on the air when it shakes out, I'll keep you posted on how that progresses. Blabbered long enough on this, so let's move on to the complete adventure and return to the Gladiator. This challenge, I must be alone. All right, the Gladiator. I think there are enough movies and books and just in history to the role of the Gladiator in Roman society and stuff to make this potentially a class that's worthwhile and not just one of those filler kind of things, but we'll see how it shakes out. They have highly trained as combat capabilities, any alignment, race, human or half-orc, minimum attributes, strength of 14, dexterity of 12, so not the easiest thing to qualify for in the world. Special ability, choice of two of the following, boxing, wrestling, and animal training. Here we go again with the animals. Restriction, no armor heavier than studded leather, limited missile weapon use. Gladiators are professional fighters who specialize in both close-range and weaponless combat. Though limited with respect to using missile weapons, gladiators may well be the deadliest class of fighter when encountered at close quarters. Trained to fight in arenas, pits, and enclosed areas, gladiators are skilled in fighters and are the only class of character who may learn to wrestle and box. Due to the time required to master their non-weapon skills, a gladiator may initially be proficient in the use of only two of the following weapons: dagger, short sword, long sword, club, flail, whip, spear, trident, and throwing net. A gladiator may gain proficiency in one new weapon per every four levels of ability, but cannot use any type of bow, crossbow, or sling. Spears and tridents may be used as missile weapon if desired. Armor heavier than studded leather is likewise prohibited, as more cumbersome protection would restrict the gladiator's weaponless combat skills. A small shield or throwing net may be used to ward blows, but only if the gladiator is engaged in combat with a weapon. If a net is used to parry, a successful parry means that the attacker's weapon-bearing arm or claw, tail, etc. is entangled. A saver's strength is required to get free of the tangled net, or it may be cut during the victim's next move. In addition to their weapon-using skills, gladiators may choose to be proficient in any two of the following three abilities. Now, this is an interesting little nugget here with the throwing net and the use of a net to parry, because, in BX, there is no throwing net kind of thing, no rules for that I can remember. Maybe Gavin Norman did in Advanced Fantasy or something. And I don't recall it being a thing in the core rules of AD&D. There may be, like, in some scenarios, maybe some kind of NPC or monster has a net and they have some kind of special rules regarding, like, a save versus something or be entangled. But this is kind of an interesting little thing. It seems to imply that, you know, anyone who takes throwing net or net could maybe do this. It doesn't seem like it's necessarily something that's unique to gladiators. But the following are. So any gladiator can choose two of the following three abilities. Number one, boxing. Boxing is the skilled use of the fists with or without cestae. And that's like those leather straps with metal studs on it and stuff. All attacks are doubled when using this skill, and parrying is possible if cestae or leather arm protection is worn. Anytime a gladiator with a skill scores a blow which does the character's maximum possible damage, the character must save versus constitution or be knocked down and stunned for one round. A gladiator may attempt a knockout by accepting a -3 penalty on the attack die. A successful hit will do double damage and cause the victim to make a save versus constitution or lose consciousness for 1 to 4 minutes. If the save is successful, the victim takes the damage but is not knocked down or knocked out. All boxing damage is half actual. 50% of such damage will heal naturally at the rate of 1 to 8 hit points per each minute of rest. So we'll find this throughout the books, or throughout the classes, that some of them have these, like, kill shot or knockout or waylaying with a kosh kind of things that kind of bypass everything except a to hit roll and a save to avoid the consequences. And I wonder what the mathematical probability is. It would behoove, I think, a lower level player character, or if you're using these as NPCs, facing off against someone that they know is a lot more powerful, to just try the knockout all the time, right? Because just chipping away at a big hit point bag isn't going to be very successful. Instead, you could just take a -3 penalty to the attack roll and potentially just take him out of the fight with one shot. So I don't know if this really is a good approach to take or not. I'm kind of leaning more towards, for instance, in my gaming, I don't use critical hits, and I think it might be more appropriate in my games to just say that, come up with a critical hit system. You, on a natural 20, something happens, right? And maybe that range gets lowered a little bit as you progress in level. So there's 19 and 20, 18, 19, and 20 for higher and higher level characters. And it either does double damage or increases the damage die or has an open-ended kind of aspect or something. But, and then just having that apply to the various specialties that a class has. So the warrior with their specialized weapon, the scout with their bow, the gladiator with boxing, etc., has access to unlock these critical hits rather than having these things that just take someone down and bypass all the hit points and stuff. So, I don't know. Very mixed opinions on this. Number two, wrestling. Wrestling is skilled grappling, and gladiators with this ability may attempt any restraint or knockdown tactic without the usual non-proficiency penalty. See Brawling Grappling, Chapter 1. Gladiators who possess wrestling skill may also attempt any of the following maneuvers. A, a takedown. is a maneuver which allows the gladiator to throw and bring down an opponent. At the gladiator's option, the throw may be a quote-unquote slam, illegal in competition, which will cause an opponent to save versus constitution or be stunned for 1 to 2 rounds. A takedown requires both skill and strength and may be attempted against any bipedal creature up to 8 feet in height. Weight limit is equivalent to the gladiator's maximum encumbrance. Right, that complicates things, but I think you can just say use some basic guidelines. If a creature's large size, maybe just say you can't do it. If you're medium height or something. Any gladiator attempting a takedown must accept a penalty of -3 on the die and must forego any attempt at parrying or dodging. A hit indicates that the takedown attempt is successful and the victim has been forcibly brought to the ground under the gladiator's control. Consider victim restrained. Characters with wrestling ability cannot attempt this maneuver. I wonder, that seems really weird. What? Maybe it says, maybe it means that if you're using against another wrestler, you can't use it. But maybe I'm just being blind to something here, but that last sentence doesn't make sense to me. All right, B, a hold is a sophisticated wrestling maneuver requiring skill, strength, leverage, and body position. Even versus non-wrestlers, holds are difficult to apply, as the attacker must find or create an opening and exploit it with quickness and split-second timing. Characters without wrestling ability cannot use this attack form. That's underlined. All right. Any attempt at applying a hold is always made at a minimum penalty of -3, unless attempted from behind or attempted after a successful takedown. No penalty in either case. There are many different types of holds: hammerlocks, half Nelson, full Nelson, chicken wing, etc. My personal preference would be the Boston Crab or the figure four leg lock. But rather than describe each, it is much simpler to say that all holds have the following in common. I think you should create a special rule set for each hold. Successfully applied hold will completely restrain the victim. No chance of stabbing the gladiator or using any dirty trick. The procedure for escaping a hold is the same as per escaping from a wrestling or restraining maneuver, with one exception. If the victim is a wrestler, he or she may opt to save versus dexterity rather than strength. Once a hold has been successfully executed, the attacker may increase the amount of pressure being applied upon the victim's limb in such ways to cause extreme pain. This application of a hold will have the useful side effect of forcing the victim to save versus will one time each minute of pressure, or submit to the gladiator, surrender, drop a weapon, answer a question, etc. If the attacker desires, a hold can be used to cause damage, 1 to 3 points per minute plus strength bonuses, with a 1 in 6 chance of dislocating or breaking one of the victim's limbs per round. Wow, this is really powerful stuff, because I could totally see this just getting used as the go-to maneuver all the time. Note, this goes back to the the author being an amateur wrestler in high school, and I think maybe having a really high opinion of wrestling because of this. A non-wrestler grappling with a skilled wrestler is about as ludicrous a sight as a non-boxer trying to trade punches with an accomplished pugilist. To say the least, the non-skilled antagonist's chances are pretty slim in such an unfair fight. Well, you could say the same thing about a trained swordsman versus someone that's never held a sword in their life, right? I mean, okay. When two skilled wrestlers meet in combat, it is quite a different story, however. In such cases, the game judge should allow each wrestler to avoid takedown attempts or hold if the defender makes a successful save versus his or her dexterity. The same method can be used to escape from a hold. Optionally, the game judge may compare the level of the two wrestlers, find the difference between the two, and award plus modifiers to the saves of the superior wrestler. Wrestling may be done for wagers or in the arena. If a stadium or coliseum is available, characters who seek to wrestle in the arena must find and procure an agent who will arrange matches for 20 to 50% of the gladiator's earnings. In some cities and towns, festivals are held with wrestling competitions. the best wrestler in the city or town may earn both a sizable fee and a great deal of a last temporary adulation. I'd have to really kind of play with these rules to find out just how powerful, and granted, it is limited to the size of your opponent and that they're bipedal and things like that with some of these maneuvers. So a lot of monsters that you face, maybe you couldn't really use your wrestling or stuff on. So, but I'm really disappointed that there's no special rules for hiding a foreign object in your tights or something and pulling that out. All right, the third thing, animal training. Gladiators who choose this skill will be able to train certain wild animals, not monsters, under the following conditions. A gladiator can only train an animal of lesser level or hit dice than his or her own level of ability. B, gladiators can train any species of wild cat, such as lions, panthers, leopards, etc., canines, apes, and bears. The time required in weeks to train any wild animal can be estimated by adding 20 to the level or hit dice of the animal and subtracting the gladiator's charisma score from this figure. At the end of the allotted number of weeks, the animal will be trained to obey one command of its master, such as attack, fetch, stay, etc. Additional commands, skills, tricks can be taught to the animal at the rate of one per each month of further training. Assume that all training requires the gladiator to expend approximately 4 hours a day with the animal that is to be trained. No more than one day per week may be missed during the training period, or the week doesn't count. A gladiator may train any number of animals, but can only control as many levels or hit dice worth of the animals as he or she has levels of ability. Trained animals may be sold for at least 100 gold pieces per level or hit die of the creature. Each additional command skill which the animal has been taught will usually double its worth. Gladiators who choose to specialize in animal training are always +1 to hit and defend against all types of wild or trained animals, not monsters. Well, I mean, this is kind of an interesting approach to just using like animal training for characters that have that as like a background skill or something. So this is interesting. All that said, I think it's probably the least likely of the three, because it's such a huge investment in time, to just get an animal that knows a couple tricks, and you can only, like, at first level, I mean, you could really only do like a dog or something, or like a small ape or a house cat or, I don't know, something that's less than one hit die. So it's not very useful at first. You couldn't even do like a wolf or any kind of great cat. I'd see most player character gladiators choosing definitely wrestling and probably boxing over animal training. But there's your gladiator. And that brings us to the Harlequin. And then we go to the Hunter. Oh, I'm just kidding. I'll review the Harlequin. What exactly, I don't even know what the heck this role is supposed to be. So let's take a look at the designer's notes to see what the authors had in mind. Harlequin. Job's Dictionary of Mythology, Folklore, and Symbols defines the Harlequin as, quote, one who conjures away by magic tricks, plays the droll, makes sport of by playing ludicrous tricks. He is a mischievous intriguer. He dances through the world and frustrates the knavish tricks of the clown. Huh. Webster's Dictionary also mentions the Harlequin's association with a wooden wand or sword. Job seems to suggest that the Harlequin thinks himself superior to the knavish tricks of the clown, an idea which was expanded to produce some of the motivations for this character class. As Harlequins were historically more apt to be members of a performing stage troupe than court fool, acting skill seemed to be a reasonable focus for the Harlequin's talents. The idea of having a character with acting abilities also seemed certain to appeal to the more dramatic types of role players. All in all, I think Cyrano de Bergerac would have approved of this character class. Break a leg. All right, from the conversion, it says, treat the Harlequin as per thieves for advancement and the saves and all that business. So we're talking about a character that would advance quickly and have kind of middling saving throws and attack rolls and a D in BX terms, like a D4 hit dice. So not your combat, frontline combat character. All right, so delving into this, combat capabilities, trained, alignment, any chaotic, race, human or half-elf, minimum attributes, charisma 15, intelligence 12, dexterity 14. So fairly hard to qualify for. Special abilities, oratory, lying, mimicry, impersonation, others, see text. Restrictions, no armor or shield of any sort, see text. That's pretty harsh for D&D style adventuring, so I don't know how well this class will fit in with, like, if your campaign revolves mainly around dungeoneering and exploring the wilderness, maybe not such a good choice. If your D&D campaign includes a lot of in-town intrigue and opportunities for demagoguery and hijinks, maybe it would work. All right, Harlequins are actors and performers of exceptional versatility and talent. Though similar in mode of dress to jesters, Harlequin consider themselves superior in all aspects to their clownish rivals and will never take work as a professional fool. Not surprisingly, the animosity between these two classes is mutual. Jesters consider Harlequins to be little more than frustrated actors. Harlequins may only be proficient in two weapons. Choice includes the dagger, short sword, sling, rapier, and throwing knife. Which reminds me, I don't think, like, the gladiator, I don't even think I had dagger as a as a potential weapon. No, that's weird. All right, anyway. While the number of weapons which a Harlequin can gain proficiency in is somewhat limited, they may acquire specialized skill with either the rapier or the throwing knife, not both. Armor or weapons may not be used by members of this profession unless they are necessary to effect an impersonation. While wearing armor of any type, Harlequin will not be able to utilize any dexterity-related skills such as juggling, acrobatics, sleight of hand, etc. The primary ability of Harlequins is acting. In order to use any of the various acting skills, a Harlequin naturally requires an audience of some sort. This audience can be as small as a single person, or as large as 200 or 300, depending on the circumstances. In any case, percent dice are rolled on the Harlequin's ability table to determine the success or believability of any performance. Note, if necessary, the Harlequin's chances of getting the attention of an audience of any size can be determined by rolling a save versus the Harlequin's charisma. Failure means the audience takes no notice whatsoever of the Harlequin. A Harlequin's acting skills include, but let's take a look here. So, oratory. This, to give you an example, or to cite the stats, starts out at a 45% chance at first level and appears to just go up by 5% per level until 11th, which it's 95, and then just goes up 1% beyond that per level. Oratory, this is the ability to affect a desired emotional response in an audience by the use of invective, calculated gestures, and picturesque speech. The Harlequin must decide beforehand what type of response he or she will attempt to elicit. Sorry, I'm just picturing El Duce on the balcony or something. Those old films of Mussolini being really flamboyant. Failure means the Harlequin's oration has had the exact opposite effect as was intended. Excuse me. Possible responses are A, sympathy. the audience will become very sympathetic towards whatever the cause the Harlequin is exposing. A sympathetic crowd will be 50% likely to offer aid to the Harlequin if he or she so desires. 50% of the time, they will merely feel sympathetic but take no action. B. Antipathy. The audience will become very angry towards any subject the Harlequin designates as a threat, nuisance, affront to all good-minded people, etc. There is a 50% chance that an audience that has been so angered can be incited to riot or do violence to the designated subjects of the Harlequin's oration. If not, there will be much shouting and milling about, but no action. C. Fascination. The audience will become very attentive and fascinated by whatever the Harlequin is doing or saying. To affect this response, the Harlequin must either be in costume wearing makeup, such as the traditional white face used by a mime, or using some sort of prop, such as a deck of cards, jugglers, pins, or balls, etc. This particular response requires a fair amount of banter and huckstering in order to be effective, and can be used to cause a distraction, diversion, or simply to stall for time. Audience interest always wanes after 5 minutes, requiring another percent die roll to maintain their attention. Failure to generate fascination always results in boredom. C. Boredom. All right. D. Boredom. The audience can be lulled into a mild stupor and made to become quite apathetic and disinterested in whatever the Harlequin chooses to designate as the subject. While this response is most often thought of as the bane of performers, it does have certain practical applications. The attention span of a bored audience is about 5 minutes, after which the listeners will grow restless and begin to leave. Note that this may be the exact response that a Harlequin is looking for. Failure to generate boredom results in fascination, but of a very unfavorable kind. The audience in this case will be very interested in jeering and verbally abusing the orator. For each minute thereafter that the Harlequin continues the oration, there is a cumulative 10% chance that the audience will become hostile and begin pelting the Harlequin with whatever is handy. Fruit, garbage, bottles, rocks, etc. If the Harlequin doesn't make a hasty retreat, the audience will run him or her out of town in very rough fashion. All right, lying. Harlequins are skilled liars and will often use this ability to deceive, mislead, and baffle those who oppose their own interests. Lying may take the form of a sob story, good for sympathy from bill collectors, shop owners, etc. Exaggeration, bluffing, attempting to assume the guise of an important or dangerous figure, or denial of guilt, even when caught red-handed. Percent dice must be rolled to determine if any lie will be believed. Optionally, the game judge may award a +5 to 20% bonus for exceptionally clever lies. If the lie is believed, the victim may still be suspicious of the Harlequin, but will take no hostile or drastic action. And lying starts out as a 40% chance at first level, going up by 5% each level beyond. You know, these things are interesting. I do wonder, like, I wouldn't use this for an NPC Harlequin to affect the attitudes of players and say, oh, you have to believe what they're saying because they passed their lying percentage, or you have to be sympathetic towards their cause because they passed their oratory. But for a player character affecting NPCs, I don't know, I suppose it's all right. I would kind of want the Harlequin PC to roleplay it out at least a little bit. Mimicry. This is the ability to verbally reproduce the vocal sounds and speech of humans and humanoid creatures. The Harlequin must, of course, hear the voice he or she will try to mimic prior to making any such attempt, and may only mimic short, 7 words or less, phrases of speech unless the individual being mimicked is well known to the Harlequin. Excuse me. Furthermore, unless the Harlequin is fluent in the language spoken by the subject, he or she will only be able to mimic those words or phrases which the Harlequin has actually heard. Mimicry starts out at 25% with a 5% increase. And it does say minus underneath the table, minus 25% if the character being impersonated is very well known, close friend, associate, etc. by the Harlequin's audience. I'd say that maybe should apply to mimicry too. All right, impersonation. This ability combines all the Harlequin's various acting skills and allows the Harlequin to assume the guise of any human or human-sized creature. A makeup kit is needed in order to affect the impersonation, as well as suitable costuming. If a specific individual is to be impersonated, the Harlequin must have gained a reasonable degree of familiarity, close observation for a minimum of 1 hour before the attempt can be made. Note that this is quite difficult, -25% chance to fool an audience that is extremely familiar with the individual whom the Harlequin is attempting to impersonate, but Harlequins suffer no additional penalties for attempting to impersonate a member of the opposite sex. Doesn't say anything about a different species, but... Alright, besides their acting skills, Harlequins may also choose to be proficient in any three of the following six talents. So, like some of the other classes in the Complete Adventurer, there is a discretionary way to customize your character here a little bit. Alright, number one, juggling. This skill allows the Harlequin to juggle three reasonably balanced objects, weighing no more than 5 pounds apiece, for an indefinite amount of time. The total number of items improves by +1 per each additional level of experience gained. Harlequins with this skill will be proficient at throwing any handheld item, not including weapons, or be able to catch any thrown missile weapon by simply making a successful save versus his or her dexterity. Failure to make the save, however, means the Harlequin is automatically struck by the missile he or she was trying to catch. In a single round, Harlequins with this skill can throw half as many items as they can juggle. Two, knife throwing. This skill allows the Harlequin to specialize in the use of any knife that is balanced for throwing. The superior accuracy of trained knife throwers is well documented, and Harlequins can choose to learn this ability. Who choose to learn this ability receive a +2 bonus to hit with regard to this weapon. Furthermore, at ranges of less than 20 feet, the deadly accuracy of this skill will allow the Harlequin to call the location of any throw. The minimum size of a called target is a 2-inch diameter area, and the Harlequin must forego the usual +2 bonus to hit, and instead accept a -3 penalty for the aimed shot. A successful called shot to any vital area, throat, heart, etc., will do double damage and cause the victim to save versus constitution or die within one to four rounds. Wow. This tactic may only be attempted once per round and may not be used versus opponents who are dodging by encumber of any sort or engaged in close combat with other individuals. Again, these save or die kind of things which bypass hit points, I really have a difficult time with that. If you're going to use hit points and only have save or die things really be centered around saving throws and magical effects, it doesn't seem to work to me so well in a D&D system. But hey, if you like critical hits and like that type of thing, maybe it will work for you. Sorry, I had to take a sip of coffee here. Number three, acrobatics. Harlequins with acrobatic skills will be able to use any of the following abilities with success or failure determined by a save versus the Harlequin's dexterity. A, climbing. Harlequins with an acrobatic ability excel at climbing ropes or sheer surface. A save versus dexterity must be made once per every 20 feet of rope or 10 feet of wall being scaled. Failure to make the save indicates a fall, though a Harlequin may possibly avoid taking falling damage by making the use of the pratfall ability, see below. Pratfall is the ability to avoid taking damage from a sudden fall. The maximum safe falling distance is 10 feet plus 2 feet per level of the Harlequin. The Harlequin may roll to cushion the impact of the fall or attempt to land on his or her feet, -2 penalty in the latter case. Leaping. This is essentially the same as per the swordsman's leaping ability, with one exception. The Harlequin may use this skill as an attack form by leaping upon an opponent from above. death from above. 1 to 6 points of bludgeoning damage per each 10 feet of drop, the Harlequin taking a quarter of the total damage, or hurling himself or herself directly at the opponent. In the latter example, damage is limited to only 1 to 4 points, but the victim of such an attack must save versus dexterity or be knocked to the ground. In any case, a to-hit roll is not necessary for this form of attack. Huh? So this is kind of like, from above, it's like the Scottish Highlander kamikaze, and I don't know, from you're just like a human bowling ball, I guess, in the latter. D, Stunt. This is the premier ability of the Harlequins who possess acrobatic skill, and perhaps the most interesting. A player Harlequin who elects to attempt a stunt may combine up to 3 acrobatic maneuvers of any type, with success or failure riding on a single die roll versus the player's dexterity. So long as none of the chosen maneuvers is especially time-consuming, such as climbing more than 10 feet of wall or rope, the combination of moves can usually be performed within one round. Hang on, let me climb up here so I can dive down on top of you. Let's see. As an example, a player Harlequin may state that he or she will attempt a stunt involving 3 separate maneuvers. 1, the Harlequin will leap from the high balcony and grab a chandelier. 2, swing across the room and hurl himself through a stained glass window. And 3, land safely on the ground 10 feet below. So long as none of these maneuvers is individually beyond the Harlequin's capabilities, the stunt has a chance of succeeding. If this is not the case, the stunt will always fail. If the stunt fails for any reason, the exact point where the failure occurred is simple enough to determine by rolling a d6 and dividing by 2. The result of 1 to 2, the first maneuver is the one that failed, 2 to 3 is second, etc. Depending on which maneuver failed, the consequences could vary considerably and is up to the game judge to determine the possible ramifications of a failed stunt. It should be noted that despite the obvious risks involved, a stunt is the only way in which a Harlequin can attempt more than one acrobatic maneuver in a given round. Well, this is, you know, this is one of the better, I mean, not that I've seen a lot of different mechanisms for acrobatics in game systems and stuff, but this doesn't seem like it's all that. I don't know about the Scottish Highlander kamikaze thing, but depending, I mean, if you're up like 50 feet, do you have to make an attack roll? I guess all you do is need to make a dex check, and you'll nail them for, if you're 50 feet up, 5 die, 6 points of damage, and you take a quarter of the damage. I don't know. All right. One of the other 6 abilities you can choose from. 4, sleight of hand. Harlequins with this ability are capable of attempting any of the relatively minor feats of so-called magic, which a sideshow magician is capable of doing. This repertoire of tricks can range from the standard rabbit out of the hat routine to making small items such as coins, jewelry, and the like disappear, or mysteriously appear in someone else's pocket, hair, hat, etc. The latter type of trick is performed by palming, concealing in the hand the item in question, and offers many practical applications to the clever player, while the former type of trick requires the player character or player Harlequin obtain the necessary props prior to any such attempt. In both cases, a successful save versus dex means that the audience has not detected the sleight of hand. Depending on their intelligence, certain audiences may be convinced that the Harlequin is a real magician or wizard. 5, minor magic. Harlequins with this skill may learn 1 first-level sorcerer spell for every 4 levels of ability, and are 50% likely to be able to decipher any simple magical script, and may use any type of magical rod or wand. That's pretty good. Note that Harlequins with this skill may never rise above the first level of magical ability with respect to the potency of their spells. 6, fencing. The dexterity of Harlequins is such that they may become quite skilled with the rapier or dueling sword. Player Harlequins who choose this ability receive a +1 bonus when attacking or pairing with a rapier. Yeah, that's pretty blah. Alright, so there you have it. The Harlequin. Is it any better than the Bard? I don't know. At least it's it seems to be, to me at least, have more of a defined kind of set of guidelines or whatever that you can do. Not that the bar doesn't have rules for all that, but in many cases it just feels like it's a cobbled together jack of all trades with some kind of musical ability, and I don't know. I have a feeling that this class would probably and the way it's played would probably grate on my nerves as much or even more than the bard. So if any of my players actually wanted to play this class, I'd probably give them a big eye roll and ask them why. But hey, there it is. If this sounds like your jam, check it out. I'm going to draw the curtains closed here after the Harlequin on this episode, this installment of the deep dive into the Complete Adventure. Otherwise, I'll go over an hour, and I'd rather not do that. So, thanks to Jason for your call today. Thanks to everyone else for listening. I'm starting to feel the time running out on Down in a Heap, so I'm going to try and rush through the Complete Adventure in the next few days here. And then beyond that, I don't know. I'll be on vacation for a while, and I don't know. The Complete Adventure might be along with the last installment of the Universal Monster series might be the end. But I had another idea for a series, but it would probably require way too much reading on my part to try and get it in. So, I don't know. Stay tuned. We'll see. But thanks for listening. And until I talk to you again, don't go down in a heap.